This episode is sponsored by Indeed. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes of this show, booking guests across time zones, tight turnaround edits, and constant time management. And when things get chaotic, you realize pretty quickly how important it is to have the right person on your team. If I had to hire someone tomorrow, I wouldn't just want a good editor. I'd want someone who understands pace in long-form interviews and can work fast under pressure. And in moments like that, you think, this is a job for sponsored jobs. Because Indeed sponsored jobs boost your listing in search results, helping you reach the candidates with the specific skills and experience you actually need. And it works. Sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's a serious edge when the pressure's on. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. 20 years ago, Jenson Button joined an elite club.
They said he might never win a Grand Prix. He's done it! Jenson Button wins the Hungarian Grand Prix! Get in there!
I remember the laps before the finish. You know, before you win your first race, the last few laps go on forever. That's what they say. And for me, I didn't want it to end. It was the best feeling, you know, leading a race by, I think it was 30 seconds. I loved every moment. I remember those laps vividly because it meant so much. You know, I was just about to achieve something that I set out to do at 8 years old.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid. I'm Tom Clarkson, and my guest this week is the 2009 world champion, Jenson Button. We're speaking 20 years on from his first F1 race win in Hungary with Honda in 2006. Jenson recalls his memories before, during, and after the race, describing the emotions, the celebrations, and how that first win changed him as a racer. That last point leads us on to a very interesting chat about when Jenson was at his best in Formula One and the insecurities that all drivers feel. JB, great to have you on the show again. How are you?
Good, thank you. Yeah, it's been a few years, hasn't it?
It has. Now, talking of years, we all love an anniversary, right? It's 20 years, would you believe it? Since that first win, Hungary 2006. Look, when you think of that weekend, let's start with this. What is the overriding memory?
Oh, they're emotions. Yeah, I mean, it went from qualifying fourth, getting a 10-place grid penalty because we had an engine failure, starting near the back, so in 14th with Fernando, with Michael, because they both got penalties in qualifying for overtaking under a yellow flag. So we're all at the back and fighting our way through. So did I think it was going to end up with a victory? No, definitely not from where we were. But it had everything, that race. You know, a lot of action, started wet, it dried out. I made a move on Michael into turn one, which kind of was a win for me anyway, before I actually got the victory. Anytime you could put one over on Michael Schumacher was impressive. And I enjoyed it very much. So much emotion and relief also, because, you know, it'd been 113 races that I've had in Formula One and hadn't won yet.
Can we start with the background, right? I mean, on the subject of not winning, you'd come close, you'd had a stack of podiums, 10 in 2004 alone. Had you got to the point where you're thinking, is this ever going to happen?
Yeah, definitely. I was at that point. You know, 2004 was an amazing year. As you said, 10 podiums. You know, the first one came and then it's like I couldn't do anything wrong that year. I was always on the podium. Pole position in Imola in front of Michael in the Ferrari, which is pretty special. But yeah, the elusive win just wasn't there. And 2005, obviously, we had our own issues with missing a few races. Yeah, it was getting a little bit painful because the team were great. But to challenge Ferrari at that time was really difficult. And then Renault appeared from nowhere, competitive with Fernando Alonso. And those two were fighting. And we were like the team behind. You know, we were the team in third in the constructors. And it was getting a little bit frustrating. So that win kind of opened up a little bit for the whole team. From that point onwards until the end of the season, I scored more points than any other driver.
35. I was going to say that. On the topic of Ferrari, Rubens Barrichello had come to BAO Honda as it was that year. Just what did Rubens bring the team that it hadn't had before? And had it felt like a one-car team before and suddenly it became two?
It's funny. I've been asked this question many times in terms of who's the driver that you feel was the best at engineering? And by far, it was Rubens. At working with a team, developing a car, understanding what a car is doing out on track and feeding that information back, but also just understanding what to do with the car, not just letting the engineer get on with it. And that's what he was really impressive at. And I understand why Michael wanted him as a teammate for so many years. And I was lucky enough to have that when we started racing together, and I could really see the skill set that he had that I never knew existed.
And a winner's mentality. I mean, did he explain why Ferrari had been so successful, and were you able to make changes within the team?
I wouldn't say so much in, you know, a winning mentality. I mean, we all want to win. We're all doing as much as we can to win. You know, it's these aren't amateur teams going up against Ferrari. You know, this is hundreds of people and with a lot of experience in the sport. So I think the mentality was always there to be winning. It's just we didn't quite have the package to do that. But I think having feedback from two drivers with experience was really important. And obviously, you know, they're going to listen to Rubens quite a lot because he's come from Ferrari and he's worked alongside Michael.
Okay, so that's the background. Let's talk about the track now. The Hungaroring. You actually won there twice in your career. Quirky little track. Feels like a sort of overgrown kart track. Was it a track you liked racing on?
It was a tough track to race on. If the conditions were dry, overtaking was quite difficult. It was like a Monaco without the barriers, you know, so you could take more risks. You could make mistakes and get away with it, unlike Monaco. But I really enjoyed it. You know, it was a fun track to drive. In mixed conditions, it was awesome, you know, because you could put it around the outside at turn two. Other places like turn five, you could drive around the outside in the wet of people. So it was a real mixed up race if it rained, and lots of opportunities in those conditions. We were also on Michelin tires at the time, and the Ferraris were on Bridgestones, which definitely helped us in those wet conditions.
What did you need from your car to be quick? Because actually the RA106 had been a little bit inconsistent at the opening of the 2006 season. Was it good in tight and twisty, or did it prefer quicker corners?
Quicker corners. Okay. Yeah, and you needed a car that was good in quicker corners in Hungary. I mean, it sounds strange, right? Because it looks so slow, but it's not. You're still unbelievably quick in most corners in Budapest. And, you know, the last sector especially, you know, you needed a good front end. It was never my strong point to have a car that had too much of a pointy front end because I didn't like oversteer that much. But it was a car that you could, as you added steering lock, it was like the dream. You got more front grip. Whereas a lot of racing cars, you get to a point and it washes out. So it was a really nice car to drive. The last corner, I just remember being frustrating in that car because it wasn't quite quick enough for the aero to be working well. So you'd always just go in there and throw in on loads of steering lock and understeer. So that's where we lost time. But most of the track, we were pretty strong.
Well, you hit the ground running, actually. Anthony Davidson, the third driver, reserve driver. Yeah. I can't even remember. We had the Friday drivers in those days. He was, what, P2 on Friday morning in first practice. And then you and Rubens lock out the second row of the grid in qualifying before the grid penalty that you mentioned. So the car felt good from the moment you put it on track that weekend.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look back now, it's hilarious because it was just the norm, you know, the way the cars looked, sounded. But, you know, that V10, when I watch videos back, just blows my mind. The scream of it. How does an engine produce that noise? It was pretty phenomenal. And, you know, to have raced in that era, I feel very, very lucky, very privileged. But, yeah, from the word go, it felt good. And then it didn't, because we had an engine failure. I remember it was after turn four, the quick left-hander. I had to pull over to the left and smoke billowing out the back of the car. And that was it. I was like, oh, 10 grid place penalty, done.
But tell us what you were thinking on race morning. You rip open the curtains. It's the first wet Hungarian Grand Prix ever. Did you start to believe at that point?
No. Or? No, not starting 14th. It never happened. You know, I'd never won a race before and I'd started on pole. So, no, definitely
You'd
not.
You'd even started on pole earlier in the year in Australia as well.
Yeah. And then stopped just before the line with the same issue as we had in testing at Hungary.
But no,
I definitely didn't. But I knew it was going to be more interesting. And the exciting thing for me was that we had the two championship rivals starting behind me or around me at that time. So I knew it was going to be a big fight through the field and it definitely was that. You know, when I watch it back and I see the fight between Michael and Fernando as well, it was an awesome race.
Look, talk about the decision about what tyres to start on, because you started on Inters from P14. Your teammate Rubens is on full wets from third on the grid. The briefing before the race, I mean, why so different?
I don't remember why Rubens was on wets. I mean, most of the time in F1, as we've experienced, you don't ever want to be on a wet tire. The only reason why you'd be on a wet tire is because it's too wet to drive on the track, you know, so you'd be behind the safety car. As soon as the safety car comes in, you want to be on an Inter because they get eaten up so quickly, a wet tire, and the blocks move around so much. Whereas the Inter tire, it just worked in those conditions. It wasn't a lot of standing water, enough to be wet, but not rivers where you needed a wet tire.
Quick word on the tire war. You already mentioned that that race weekend was, you wanted to be on the Michelins and not the Bridgestones. But did you enjoy the tire war era of Formula One?
I did. And, you know, I experienced that later on in my career in Super GT as well. For me, it's such an exciting part of racing because it's tire manufacturers going at it as well. And they're obviously trying to produce not just a safe tire like we have in Formula One now, but also they were pushing the boundaries a lot more with trying to be better than the other tire supplier. You know, what we have now is great because we have the different levels of softness that we have and we can play around with them all around the world for different types of tracks. But back then, it was like they would bring whatever they thought would work for that track, and the lap times were extraordinary, you know. And then 2005 happened and the year before 2005, where we used one tire for the whole race. And we did it. You know, it was a problem if you locked
and
up.
And they were grooved.
And they were grooved and they worked. It was just amazing. But so I really enjoyed the tire war. But, you know, all good things come to an end, you know, and I respect the way that we have it now in Formula One as well.
What about refueling? It was a refueling era as well, wasn't it?
I loved that part of it, you know, because you could have different strategies. You could run different strategies on fuel. So you could even start the race on half tanks if you wanted to have a lightning first stint, and you'd never be at full tanks because you could do a two-stop race, and you're never at full tanks. So if your car didn't work as a heavy car with the fuel moving, you just run a lower fuel level and just do more stops. Also in qualifying them, we had fuel on board. You remember? It was declared after qualifying how much fuel we had on board for the race.
We were sort of guessing, weren't we? Oh, how much? Yeah.
Yeah, so it was fun. I enjoyed that. And it left more opportunity for people that weren't in the best car, I think.
This episode is sponsored by Saily. One of the things I love about making this show is that it takes me all over the world to sit down with some fascinating people from Formula One. Of course, that also means there's always another interview to prepare, more research to do, and checking in with my family back home. And quite often I'm doing all of that while traveling between different countries, which means I rely a huge amount on having a solid data connection wherever I am. But you don't have to travel as much as I do to appreciate how useful that is. Whether you're heading away on holiday, traveling for work, or just trying to avoid expensive roaming charges, Saily makes it easy to get online whenever you need it. Saily is an eSIM app from the creators of NordVPN that gives you affordable mobile data in over 200 destinations. So instead of worrying about roaming charges or trying to find a local SIM card when you arrive, you can just connect straight away. It also includes built-in security features like a VPN and ad blocking, which helps protect your browsing and can even reduce mobile data usage by stopping ads from loading. What I really like is that you only need to install the eSIM once. After that, you can travel between countries and stay connected simply by adding a new data plan. And if you travel a lot, they also offer the Saily Ultra plan, which includes extra perks like airport lounge access, fast track services, and priority support. So download the Saily app in your app store, use the code GRID at checkout to get 15% off your first purchase. This show is sponsored by Liquid IV. You might have heard me mention that I recently trained for the London Marathon, which I'm very pleased to say I managed to finish. And congratulations to everyone else who completed it too. Liquid IV's Hydration Multiplier sugar-free sachets were really helpful during my training, thanks to its optimized ratio of electrolytes, essential vitamins, and nutrients. And now that I've got the marathon bug and we're heading into the warmer summer months, I know staying properly hydrated is only going to become even more important if I want to keep at it and keep my energy levels up on longer runs. And no matter what sun-drenched activities get you moving, you need to stay hydrated when things heat up. Liquid IV delivers longer-lasting hydration than water alone. And right now, you can get 20% off your first order with the code GRID at checkout. And what I really like is how convenient it is. The sachets are easy to take with you, whether that's in a gym bag, a backpack, or even your pocket. And just one stick mixed in 16 ounces of water can keep you hydrated for up to 4 hours. I've been alternating between the orange, vanilla, and white peach flavors recently, but there are loads of sugar-free options to choose from, so why not mix it up a little? Get moving with superior hydration from Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first purchase with the code GRID at checkout. That's 20% off your first purchase with the code GRID at liquidiv.com. This episode is sponsored by Indeed. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes of this show, booking guests across time zones, tight turnaround edits, and constant time management. And when things get chaotic, you realize pretty quickly how important it is to have the right person on your team. If I had to hire someone tomorrow, I wouldn't just want a good editor. I'd want someone who understands pace in long-form interviews and can work fast under pressure. And in moments like that, you think, this is a job for sponsored jobs. Because Indeed sponsored jobs boost your listing in search results, helping you reach the candidates with the specific skills and experience you actually need. And it works. Sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's a serious edge when the pressure's on. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs.
Jenson Button's win at Hungary in 2006 showed how every moment in sports can matter, just like in playoff hockey. In the Stanley Cup playoffs, every shift is intense. There's no coasting, and anything can happen, especially in overtime. NHL on TNT has the best coverage, with a studio crew that makes every game more fun. Paul Bissonnette brings laughs, and Wayne Gretzky breaks down the action in a way that's easy to follow. The personalities and the games together make it the place to watch. Watch the Stanley Cup playoffs on TNT, TBS, True TV, and HBO Max.
Right, back to the race, okay? We get underway. You immediately start flying, actually. That first stint was great. I think you overtook Massa, Fisichella, Schumacher in the space of 2 laps.
Yeah, it was good.
So you immediately got a tune out of the car. I've asked you this before. I'm going to ask you again. At what point in the race did you start to think something special might be on?
Definitely, I would say towards the end of that stint. I think we went to dry tires on the first stop. It was around that time because the pace was really good on the wets, on the inters, and you know I could see myself coming through the field, and they were giving me lap times of Fernando as well, and I was like, we're quicker, this is great. And then when we put the dry tires on, the pace was really strong, and at that moment I thought, yeah, I actually thought it was on before it was on, if you know what I mean. At that moment I was like, we're going to win this. I didn't realize the offset that we had with Fernando with pit stops. I thought it was a walk in the park, and then I was like, oh no, actually Fernando's in front. And then he had his wheel nut fall off in turn two, and life was made a lot easier for me. I didn't have to challenge him.
He's off! Fernando Alonso is off! The world championship leader has stopped, and Jenson Button not only leads, but he leads by 22 seconds. Is it too soon to start talking about the first Grand Prix victory of Jenson Button?
Do you think you had the pace to pass him if he kept going?
Passing him, I don't know. But we had the pace to catch him. But passing is another thing always in F1, and with the way the track was, you know, drying track, it's always difficult to put it on the wet patches to overtake. So you've got to force an error from the guy in front.
How did your race engineer, Andrew Shevlin, break the news that Fernando was out? Was he very calm, or was he like, JB, you're not going to believe this?
It wouldn't have been calm. It would have been unbelievably excited. You know, when you've never achieved something and you think you might be able to, everything changes, you know. And even though we're British and we don't like showing too much emotion, Shovers did. And I really loved that about him. And that's why we work so well together. Yeah, I mean, it would have been proper excited, definitely. I didn't even know that I was racing Fernando at that point. So I thought I was in the lead anyway.
Let's hope the floodgates now open for Jenson Button, as they did for Nigel Mansell and for Damon Hill before him, because here in his 113th Grand Prix start, he's proved the critics wrong. They said he might never win a Grand Prix. He's done it! Jenson Button wins the Hungarian Grand Prix! Get in there!
You cross the line. You've won your first race. 20 years on, how vividly do you remember the emotions?
I remember the laps before the finish. You know, before you win your first race, the last few laps go on forever. That's what they say. And you hear different things and worried that you're going to have a failure. For me, I didn't want it to end. It was the best feeling, you know, leading a race by, I think it was 30 seconds. I asked the team, is everything okay? You know, a couple of times with the car, they're like, yep, just keep doing what you're doing. And I loved every moment. I remember those laps vividly because it meant so much. You know, I was just about to achieve something that I, you know, set out to do at 8 years old. And then I caught the Honda junior team, which was Super Aguri. I remember that on the last lap, I called up to them. I was like, oh, this would be nice. We can cross the line together when they're a lap down or two laps down. But that would be nice for Honda. But you couldn't keep up. So,
and you weren't slowing down.
I wasn't slowing down. You know, at that moment, you start backing off, your concentration goes. You don't want to be messing with that. You got to keep focused. You might not be 100%, but it's 99%.
And JB, it was an incredible podium of firsts, actually. So, your first win, it was the team's first win, it was De La Rosa's first podium. Heidfeld had given BMW Sauber their first podium as well. Can you remember what was said? Or when in that moment, is it just all about you?
No, there was a lot of emotion on the podium. I noticed it more from Pedro. There's a lot of photos of us hugging. A lot. And staring into each other's eyes. It was his first podium and it was his last in Formula One. It was his one and only. So I spoke to him yesterday about it, actually. And as it's the anniversary, and he was like, you don't understand how emotional it was for me as well, being up there, given this opportunity to go and race for McLaren after Juan Pablo was moved aside. So yeah, it was a lot of emotion up there. And I think for the first win to be Hungaroring with that beautiful trophy, I think that means a little bit more. I think, I know it's the first win, but I think because of the trophy and the effort and dedication that goes into designing that trophy and building it, it means that extra bit more.
How did you celebrate?
Yeah, I had to go straight to China, because I had a sponsor event in China.
I remember that, yeah.
So yeah, I had a couple of beers at the track, jumped on a private plane, which took us to a bigger airport, which then I flew to China and did an event on it's not a gondola, but it was like a gondola on the water. And I was like, this is so random.
It's quite random.
Yeah, yeah. And then obviously got the call from Big Boss at Honda. You've just won our first race in 40 years. Can you come to Japan? I'm like, all right. Here we go.
While you're in the region.
Yeah, here it goes. But I arrived in Japan and went to the Honda R&D center. I remember walking in and the corridor, it's a completely open plan office. And the corridor is, it feels like it's half a kilometer long. It feels like it's 500 meters long. I'm sure it's not. But every single worker there came and stood by the middle corridor to clap me down. And it lasted like 20 minutes walking down there. And it was pretty awesome. You know, there was so much emotion. They'd put so much into the team. And it had been a long time since Honda won as a manufacturer. So a lot of tears, and that added to my emotion as well. So it was actually the best way to kind of celebrate.
And that cemented your relationship with Honda, who you're still working with today, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's, you know, I've raced for Honda, obviously 2003 through to 2008, 15, 16, and then 17, 18, 19 in Super GT. And then I raced for them in the Daytona 24, where we got a podium.
Did you approach Turkey, the next race, any differently? You know, they talk about the confidence you get from your first win. Did you feel any of that?
I think I was more relaxed. I was less tense.
Monkey off your back.
Yeah, I think that's the feeling that you have. You know, it's less tense. I'm not going to win the world championship, so it's let's go out and do as well as we can. I've won that race. I can take a few more risks now, you know. And it was probably some of the best races of my career. One, because I was so relaxed. You know, people talk about the Braun season being my best year in an F1. It wasn't, I don't think. And
when were you at your best, JB?
I think 2006 was a really good year for me, the second part of the season. And 2011, I would say, in McLaren.
The 2 years you won in Hungary.
They are the 2 years I won in Hungary, yes. My 114th Grand Prix and my 200th Grand Prix, I remember.
2007 and 2008 were quite quiet years.
Difficult years.
Difficult years.
Really difficult.
Remember the Earth car and things like that. When did the foundations for 2009 start getting laid? When you look back, did it start in 2006 with that win in Hungary?
I would say maybe with Honda, but in terms of the UK based, no. I mean, we expected so much out of 2007 and it just was a disaster. It really was. You know, our junior team, Super Guri, had our 2006 car. So they were beating us. That car had won a race and we were driving something that couldn't even get into the points with. So that was a tough year. And then it was more when Ross turned up at the end of 2007. That was the moment that, you know, it was like, oh, this is going to turn around. And that you felt the mood shift. A team that had won a race suddenly was so bad in 2007. I think it needed that kickstart again for someone like Ross.
What did Ross bring?
I think just his presence, first of all, just him walking into the room was enough. You know, I remember it was like assembly. We had the whole factory in one room and nobody really knew that Ross was coming. And that's when it was announced and he walked down the middle aisle and there he was at the front and he was our savior. He was the person that was going to come in and save us from the disastrous 2007.
JB, I'd love to know, look, can we explore this a bit more? What did Ross bring other than his presence? Was it a confidence? Was it a direction?
Well, yeah, I hadn't got to that bit yet. Okay. I wasn't just his presence, but that was already a kickstart. You know, that was a good kickstart for the team. But yeah, his leadership, his understanding of how a team needs to work together, getting rid of blame culture within a team, letting people be a bit more free within a team and, you know, come up with crazy ideas. And sometimes they don't work, but they've got to take risks. Otherwise, you're never going to get to the front. So it was a really good atmosphere when Ross was there. 2008 was made very difficult because we knew we were just concentrating on 2009. So 2008 was kind of like, there you go, have that. And it wasn't great. It was pretty bad. And I'd sort of mentally switched off at that point. because I knew this the year was going to be a disaster. I feel that Rubens probably did a better job in that situation than I did in 2008. I was more already looking at 2009 and I was just going through the motions on race weekends, because once you'd won, it felt, what am I doing here? You know, fighting for 13th, 14th on the grid, and it's not what I set out to do. So it was tough, and I think I gave up a bit too early that season when I look back now.
Did Ross make you a better racing driver?
I think his calm attitude was great. You know, on tough days, I don't think that anyone can make you a better racing driver. It's down to yourself to sort out your demons. You know, I think people can listen, and I think that's what you need to do as a leader. Listen to your driver's problems, but don't be too opinionated. You know, as drivers, we're flawed. We are insecure. And I'll go for any driver. You know, when I hear Lewis Hamilton on the radio last year in the Ferrari, when he asks a question, they don't come back to him. And he's like, have I done something wrong? It's like, you're a 7-time world champion. You know, the confidence you should have is out of this world, but, you know, insecurities creep in. So I think being, you know, listening to drivers and their issues is a big thing, I think, for leaders and a team.
Insecurities drive you on, I suppose, as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, you forget what you've achieved and you just think about that last session. You're like, oh, I'm not good enough. You know, I was 2 tenths behind my teammate. It's crazy. And the pressure you put yourself under, it's enormous. And that's why you see so many drivers fail in the sport, even though they have the talent. Mentally, they're just in a really dark place. And I've heard it from many drivers. And, you know, we think of it as a weakness, so we don't talk about it. And that's what amazed me with Lando, you know, the way he's been outspoken over the last couple of years on mental health. Really, really good. And I think that gives you a lot of strength.
Do you think Michael Schumacher had those insecurities?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Because certainly the public persona was exactly. one of great
of
confidence.
Course. Yeah. You know, when there's certain drivers, riders in MotoGP that I've thought, he comes across as a bit arrogant. But it's not. They just don't want to let anyone in. You know, they know they have insecurities and they don't want to let people in, and which is the biggest issue, because then you never get over those insecurities. Yeah.
So JB, your career, you experienced every emotion under the sun, didn't you, really? Highs
yeah.
and lows. So when you look at 2026, so we just end on the current year, who do you look at this year and go, they're like me? I can relate to that driver. He drives like me. His attitude is like me. If all the ducks align, he can win the world championship, even if he hasn't already. Who's that person?
It's a difficult question to ask. You know, we're all built so differently. And I'm not inside any of the drivers' heads. I think in my younger years, I would say probably Oscar. His driving style.
You were chilled. I remember being at the showdown in, where were we, January 2000. It was you and Bruno Junqueira. Now, I know the sort of innocence of youth, what you don't know, but I was bowled over at Barcelona then, just thinking, how can JB be so relaxed? His entire future rests on what we're doing now.
Yeah.
You know, you go Oscar-esque, I suppose.
Go from being a kid that likes racing cars to an F1 driver. Yeah. Your world changes. Not just your career, but everything else in your world changes. So,
but very Oscar-esque, I think, is
yeah,
the point.
I think so. And the racing was what I was all about. You know, I wasn't bad at doing media and sponsor events, but it wasn't what I enjoyed. It was just the driving that I loved. And also, you know, in moments in my career, I wasn't there mentally. You know, I wasn't strong enough at certain moments. And I don't want to put that on Oscar. But, you know, when you look at last year, there were moments in time that I felt that he wasn't able to get the best out of himself. And sometimes you do tighten up. And that was a weakness of mine. So, and 2009, it was in plain sight. And I don't mind talking about it because it's something that I worked on. So, yeah, I think probably Oscar. And it's lovely to see him and his dedication and his focus. And he just wants to go racing. Very like Max as well. No, I'm not like Max in terms of I'm nowhere near as good as him. But, and also the way that he races is very different.
Do you think Max has the insecurity as well?
Yes. I still think there's an insecurity there. Yeah.
Maybe that applies to all professional sports.
I think it does. And it comes down to you lose more than you win. You know, I spoke to Roger Federer last year about sport and the mental side of it. And he said, yeah, well, you got to think I'm the most successful tennis player ever. and I lost 75% of my matches. And that's a great record. You know, in F1, I raced 300 Grand Prix. I won 15. 15. So I lost 285 races.
Hang on, 50 podiums or whatever it was.
Yeah. But talking about victories. So yeah. Lewis Hamilton, extraordinary what he's achieved, but he's still lost a lot more than he's won. And that is mentally why it's tough in any sport, because you lose more than you win.
JB, it's been such a joy to chat to you again and to relive that Hungary race. Thank you so much for your time.
Cheers, Tom.
That was a brilliant chat. Thank you, Jensen, for your time and for your memories from 20 years ago. You remembered so much from your first win, and why wouldn't you? I hope everyone involved in that win, especially Andrew Shovlin, your race engineer, will enjoy reminiscing as much as we did. Well, that's almost it for this week. Before I go, a few parish notices for you. On the latest episode of F1 Nation, I'm joined by Jolyon Palmer and James Hinchcliffe to talk about the greatest teammate rivalries in F1 history. And this week's F1 Explains is all about press officers with former McLaren communications director Sophie Ogg. That will be on the F1 Nation feed on Friday. Thanks very much for listening. I will, of course, be back next week with another iconic name from the pinnacle of motorsport. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.